Our next case is United States v. Palik. Major Blythe, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Captain Washburn, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Matthew Blythe, and together with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos, we represent the appellant in this case. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Defense counsel have wide latitude in the strategic preparation of their case, but that latitude has limits. Rule for Courts Martial 914 was the perfect tool for dealing with the government's deletion of the complaining witnesses. Unrebutted testimony showed that the government recorded it and that a brand new investigator didn't know how to preserve the evidence.
Counsel, on that point, there was no finding that it was recorded, and there was no finding that it was lost. I mean, there is evidence, and as you point out, that the testimony is that it was recorded and that it was lost. But there was never a finding, either by the military judge or the CCA, that it was either recorded or lost. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. By virtue of the defense counsel failing to raise the motion, they didn't have the evidentiary hearing that would have followed, based even on the simple fact of the testimony that did come out. It's our position that, based on the Jenks Act and RCM 914, that the foundation required for the defense to trigger that hearing is simply the testimony that came out, that there was a recording, and that was unrebutted, from Special Investigator HO on pages 48, 49, 53, 54, and 55. She repeatedly refers to it as being recorded. And I'd like to talk about the deficient performance in this case. And one of the ways we can assess that is, what was the knowledge, what was the understanding of the rule that the defense counsel possessed at the time they were making the decision? And we can cull from their declarations a couple of important points. One is their belief about this court's decision in SIGRA. Both Major A.N. and Captain O.H. said that had SIGRA come out before this case, that might have changed their analysis. And it's worth pausing to consider why that would be. Because all that this court resolved in SIGRA is the question on appeal of the standard of prejudice when a military judge has denied an RCM 914 motion. It's essentially irrelevant to the trial question of should you or should you not raise a motion under RCM 914. So nothing changed in the law with SIGRA. The fact that the defense counsel believed that SIGRA should have changed their decision only shows that they didn't understand RCM 914. What SIGRA does show is it makes it painfully evident that the only thing to do here was to file the motion. A second thing that we can see from their declarations is that they, like the government on appeal here, believe that there's some kind of obligation under RCM 914 or under the Jenks Act to prove that the recording existed in a functional format. That's not found in any of these court's cases. In fact, if a reasonable informed attorney had read this court's cases, would see that that has occurred time and again, not just with this court, but even going back even earlier, the Supreme Court in Augenblick, there's no indication that the tapes at issue there, that anyone actually reviewed them. This court's predecessor in Marsh, at issue were Article 32 hearing tapes. There's no indication that anyone reviewed them to make sure that they functioned. Moving on to Clark, where the facts there were 2 days of interviews at CID, and 5 discs were supposed to be produced as a result of that. Disc 1 and Disc 4 had the same contents. There's no indication in the facts of the case that anyone reviewed the second days of the video to make sure that it functioned. And in SIGRA, the same thing. There's the 3 interviews at issue, the victim interview and 2 other witness interviews. There's no indication anyone reviewed them to make sure that they worked. So I think it's a decent indication that the government here needs this court to establish a new rule to protect what defense counsel did or didn't do below.
Well, counsel, part of the argument was that we didn't know that they actually existed and couldn't prove it, and you've just addressed that. But part of it was we were worried that they might exist, and we didn't want the government to look for them.
Yes, sir. Are you referring to defense counsel's argument?
Defense counsel, yeah.
Yes, sir. Well, and I think a couple of responses to that. One, I don't think that was reasonable on the facts of the case. And two, I think that that analysis that they put forward really spoke to a different moment in time. On the first point, On the Joint Appendix on page 41, there's an indication that Special Investigator H.O. had to meet with the complaining witness here because she was worried about the impact of the loss of the video. And she thought it was going to affect the trial adversely, and perhaps she was prescient. So they had the incentive. That's all the way back in December of 2020 to go and find that video. And this video is not like some other cases where there are physical tapes that were once on a paralegal's desk. Maybe if we turn the office upside down, we'll be able to locate it. This existed presumably on a server somewhere, and it's gone. There's no indication anywhere in the record that they'd be able to retrieve what was overwritten, presumably, if the facts are the same as they were in SIGRA.
But how can we rely on those sort of assumptions in saying that defense counsel's view was unreasonable? I mean, there's just not enough evidence about in the record and no findings on any of these points.
Well, it's true that the record doesn't have any findings, Your Honor, but I think our essential point is that defense counsel had all the information they needed in order to raise that motion to trigger the hearing. And if that hearing occurred, they would have the ability to draw out some of the facts that were necessary. Now, in terms of the possibility of later the videos arising later, that may have had some resonance as a pretrial matter for RCM 703E2. Had they have moved under that rule, the remedies there would be abatement or continuance, which may not have been what defense counsel would want at that moment if they went to trial. But in that different moment, in trial, RCM 914 kicks in after SM testifies on direct, and the military judge's remedies are only to strike her testimony or a mistrial, both of which are incredibly advantageous. And the default remedy that defense counsel have asked for and that this court in SIGRA noted was the correct thing to do when there's an RCM 914 violation is to strike the complaining witness's testimony. And so had they have been fully informed about this court's precedent on RCM 914, that was the decision to make, was to raise the motion under RCM 914, find the facts, and potentially have what is a windfall for the defense if the government is unable to produce these statements. And the defense was on notice of this before trial in order to prepare, in order to read through this court's cases, in order to prep itself for what might be the challenges that it would face.
But it would only be a windfall if the records never materialized. But if the government found them, it could greatly limit cross-examination because then the government could bring in prior consistent statements. And didn't they, in the affidavit, defense counsel said, we know of other cases where we asked for things and the government went and found them and it was harmful.
Yes, Ron, to the point about Major Ann did mention in the declaration that there was a parallel case. That was when there was another case where surveillance records appeared from that case that were not actually part of it. All that's at issue here are the two discrete recordings with SM. And as far as there's no indication other than that they were recorded and that they were deleted for an unknown reason. And so the minimal threat that somehow they might materialize is massively outweighed by the benefits of RCM 914 because it is such a powerful rule for defense counsel if they harness it properly and if they understand its power and when to use it. And I think one of the points that the government makes here was that defense counsel also might have thought that the good faith loss doctrine would have protected the government's conduct here. But I think had this been a fully informed defense counsel that had read through this court's cases and federal precedent would have seen that that's not actually the case. So in Jerry, this court's predecessor noted that the good faith loss doctrine is limited in its application. But this court has repeatedly said in Wackel and Thompson and Clark that negligence may suffice to defeat the good faith loss doctrine. This court also in Wackel cited Moore, a federal case on point, that has essentially the same holding, that negligence alone may suffice. And the negligence here is twofold. Special Investigator on page 41 of the Joint Appendix, it indicates that she was unaware of the time frame for copying those videos to a disk to preserve them. But this is also her first week on the job. And as far as the record reflects, she's the person that was supposed to preserve this evidence. OSI knew that she was new on the job because Special Agent had to take an outsized role in the interview. Normally, he'd be a secondary note taker, but instead, he acts somewhere in between. He's asking questions. He's also trying to take notes because he knows that she's new. She should never have been in that situation where she's the primary person responsible for evidence preservation, which under the Jenks Act and under RCM 914 observed. There's also from the declarations we can see that defense counsel appear not to recognize that OSI was apparently committing routine RCM 914 violations. They both suggested that OSI records interviews and then allows them to be overwritten. If that was the routine practice, that's problematic on one end, but it also should have been a trigger for them to be even more aware of RCM 914 if they are, in fact, repeatedly overwriting evidence, as CID did in Clark and in SIGRA.
You're walking through all of the errors, as it were, that the defense counsel committed. Is it your position, or do you think that the military judge has a sui sponte duty to essentially find the RCM 914 issue? You know, should the military judge have said something?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't think it falls to the military judge to do that. If for no other reason than the judge may not have the information in order to do that. The way that this came out in trial, I'm not sure that the judge, even if he was finely tuned to this, would have put the pieces together to realize that the loss occurred. By the end of the cross-examinations, perhaps, but I think it's ultimately a tool for defense counsel or trial counsel to use in the right circumstance. But I don't think the judge has a sua sponte duty to do that. I don't think there's anything wrong had the judge have raised the issue, but I think it's ultimately for the parties, and I believe it has to be on motion of the opposing party in order to trigger the rule. So I'm not sure that there's, now that I think about it more, I'm not sure that there's latitude for the judge to do that if it's on the opposing party to raise the motion.
Okay.
When we're assessing the burdens, when we're assessing our obligation on an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we're in the unusual position here where most of the time appellants fail on prejudice in ineffective assistance of counsel claims. But because we're here due to an RCM 914 issue, the question is there a reasonable probability of a different result had defense counsel have filed the motion? And we detail in our briefs and today about the reasons why there is at least a reasonable probability of success on that motion. As the Supreme Court said, that's less than a preponderance of the evidence. That's what we would have to show.
Counsel, weren't there written statements provided by the victim to investigators in this case?
Not in this case, Your Honor. SM did not. In some of this court's other cases, and that's one distinction. For here, there were no alternative written statements. But in many other cases, that SIGRA being one example, where there were written statements, extensive written statements, in addition to the videos. Here, we're only left with the video. And we can see in the case how that ended up being problematic, because in the absence of the video, defense counsel tried to cross-examine on what happened in that interview, and she said, I don't remember. Well, then they weren't able to refresh her recollection with the video. Instead, they tried to call a special agent to say what she said in the interview. And typically, you know, the agent might have reviewed the video and could talk about what was there. But his memory was limited to really not memory at all, just what was in his notes. And so when he was pinned down, he had to say, listen, I can't tell you whether something was in there, whether she said something or not. I only have what's in the notes. And so that was one of the ways the defense was handled.
And I'm back to SIGRA. In SIGRA, you had kind of this very different situation on the good faith exception here, so to speak. And there, the government conceded that the government had showed insufficient evidence. In other words, they were sufficiently culpable to preclude the good faith loss doctrine. But so that we as the court never really had to decide that issue. So how does that affect how we look at this case, where there are no findings at all made by the military judge, in determining whether or not the good faith, or whether or not the counsel would have been successful on the motion, given the availability of the government of the good faith exception?
Well, Your Honor, I think.
Or doctrine, I should say.
Yes, Your Honor. I think even though there are factual distinctions with SIGRA in this case, in terms of the government's concession there, here, I think when the assessment is just about ineffective assistance, I don't think it's the same burden of showing that we would have necessarily prevailed on RCM 914, we would have hit all the buckets, because it's only a reasonable probability. The evidence that was out there, the law that was out there.
But I got to go back to Judge Maggs's point, is that we don't have any findings, and so we're kind of at a, it's kind of difficult to even come to a conclusion of what a reasonable probability would be on success of the motion.
But isn't your point there that there were no findings because of the ineffective assistance?
Yes, Your Honor, and to answer both of your questions, Your Honor, I think it's because the defense had the information in order to go ahead and raise the motion to get the facts of what they did. So, for instance, in Segura, where defense counsel properly, on almost identical facts, raised the RCM 914 motion, that allowed the judge to hold that hearing, talk more focused with the agents about what happened, and provide a sufficient foundation for ruling on the motion. So I think that's what would have been the prudent step here, given what was before defense counsel, and that failure to take that step was a deficient performance.
And your position is that there's enough to look forward without the actual findings to make a conclusion what a reasonable determination would be on the success of the motion.
Yes, Your Honor. I think based on the factual parallels with this court's cases in the past, the defense counsel would have been able to essentially raise the motion.
Okay.
Barring any questions from the court.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you. Captain Washburn.
Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Tyler Washburn, and along with Colonel Matthew Talcott, we represented the United States. This court should find trial defense counsel were not ineffective for two reasons. One, no relief can be granted unless appellant demonstrates that no reasonable lawyer in the same circumstances would have thought an RCM 914 motion would be futile. And two, even if this court were to find the recordings did exist, a reasonable attorney could have believed a military judge would have applied the good faith loss doctrine. In the present case, three reasonable judges determined trial defense counsel were not ineffective. A fair assessment of attorney performance requires every effort to overlook the benefits of hindsight, and judicial scrutiny needs to be highly deferential and should not be colored by those distorting effects of hindsight. When a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel is premised on counsel's failure to make a motion to suppress evidence, an appellant must show that there is a reasonable probability that such a motion would have been meritorious.
Well, let's talk about this case. Here, they could have filed a 914 motion, and they chose not to. And in their affidavits, they gave their explanations why. And the CCA at least found those were reasonable. So walk me through why, because it seems to me there's a lot of upside of filing the motion and virtually no downside. So explain to me why their decision not to do it was reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. A reasonable attorney could have filed a 914 motion, but conversely, a reasonable attorney could have determined that based on the facts known to trial defense counsel at the time that they were making the strategic decision, that an RCM 914 motion would have been futile. Specifically looking at
futile okay, go ahead. I'll let you go.
Thank you, Your Honor. Looking specifically at what trial defense counsel knew, because ultimately an ineffective assistance of counsel claim is viewed both in a somewhat subjective light, but it also is an objective test. And part of that objective test is looking at what trial defense counsel knew when they made the decision not to file the 914 motion. And what they knew at the time was, one, that there was an internal data page in OSI's records that indicated that there were recordings that no longer existed. However, after...
You say that no longer existed. Didn't one of the defense counsel, indicate, use the word in her description of it as being deleted? And how do you delete something unless it had been recorded?
Your Honor, you are correct in that that is the word that was used in the internal data page. It was deleted. And those are OSI's words. But OSI's words, and both in the IDPs as well as their testimony at trial, the word deleted ultimately doesn't have the same meaning that we would typically connotate deleted with.
What other possible meaning does it have?
It means that they speculated as to why these recordings no longer existed to begin with.
Now, when you say speculated, let me quote what the special investigator H.O. testified to. She said, quote, those interviews were deleted off the system. There's an unknown reason. However, they were deleted before we were able to put them on a CD. Now, you say it's speculation, but we're dealing with the record rather than speculating about speculation.
Understanding that, Your Honor, it's imperative to look at what was contained within trial defense counsel's declarations, because that what they knew from assistant trial counsel sort of intervening after the discovery of the IDPs is extremely relevant to their analysis. And specifically, what was disclosed by assistant trial counsel in July, while this internal data page was created back in January, it was disclosed to trial defense counsel that assistant trial counsel could not confirm whether this recording ever existed to begin with. They could not confirm whether it was deleted and or recorded and subsequently lost, nor could they confirm whether it had ever been recorded to begin with, because no one, including assistant trial counsel, nor either of the two OSI agents who worked had ever reviewed the recording, had ever testified that they viewed it in any working format, that they had ever seen it at the conclusion of the interview.
They testified that it was their procedure to record them, and that part of their procedure was that after some amount of time they get overwritten. Right, that testimony is in the record. So isn't that the – like, why wouldn't we think that's what happened? Why wouldn't the defense counsel have thought that's what happened?
Well, Your Honor, I will agree that ultimately that is what was testified to at trial. However, it's important to note, and an appellant has brought it up, we have a situation where we have an inexperienced OSI agent.
Doesn't that make it worse? Right, we're trying to figure out whether the government was negligent. Part of this analysis was whether the government would be negligent or grossly negligent in losing them. And so the explanation of we didn't properly train our employees, so don't worry about it. I don't see how that helps your case.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree in that it makes it more likely that the reasons outlined by trial defense counsel in their declarations, their alternative explanations for what could have happened to the statements. And their analysis as to whether those statements ever existed to begin with. Specifically, they looked at whether there was potential user error, because what was also testified to at trial was that there was the recording system utilized by OSI required an affirmative step by the OSI agent to press and accurately operate the recording software. And an inexperienced agent very well could have made an error or not understood how to utilize the recording software appropriately, and that would have been a reasonable explanation for why the recordings never existed to begin with. And another reasonable alternative that in their experience trial defense counsel had dealt with was an error where the software recording equipment just didn't cooperate. For whatever reason, there was an error in the software and it didn't record the interview.
But this is all very hypothetical. What we have is testimony from the investigators that said normally it would be recorded. Here we didn't transfer it to disk before. Our policies say it would be overwritten. And so we're dealing both with a policy that the government puts in place that despite its massive resources has said, look, we're only going to keep these for 30 days. And then we're just going to assume the risk that if we don't copy it off, it gets deleted. I don't see how that, like all of these things are bad facts for the government, right? They make it look like the government's not being very diligent about keeping these things that they have a duty to preserve.
Well, Your Honor, I think would respectfully disagree in that, yes, if the recordings had existed to begin with, there's absolutely a duty to preserve them. However, there is no duty under 914 to create the evidence to begin with, and I think that's where the pivotal issue of this case hinges.
But I still don't see how the answer that, like, well, we were negligent in creating them, so therefore we shouldn't be found negligent in preserving them.
Understanding your point, Your Honor, ultimately the government's position is that they were never recorded or never created to begin with, and whether that be because of user error, whether that be because of software, appellant has not demonstrated.
That's all hypothetical. There's nothing in the record that supports that theory.
Well, I would argue, Your Honor, that relying on OSI's practices or their standards or their policies is also somewhat hypothetical, because we're expecting an inexperienced agent to follow new guidelines and new regulations. But it's also...
Yes. We expect special investigator to comply with the regulations, even if they're 12 hours old.
Yes, Your Honor. But it's also important to note specifically what wasn't testified to at trial. There was no testimony that either of those agents specifically remembered going in and activating the recording equipment. There was no testimony that at the conclusion of the interview they verified that the recording equipment had operated correctly. There was no testimony that at any point, any time, that those agents had ever seen those recordings in existence in any sort of digital format ever. And that, while the testimony at trial was that there were policies in place, ultimately what the evidence shows, or the lack of testimony shows, is that that is all speculation as to whether they were ever recorded to begin with.
But we're dealing in a world of speculation. IAC claims live in a world of speculation. We don't know the answer to any of these questions because the defense counsel didn't raise the issue, right? There could have been, this could have all been investigated and resolved at the time, and they chose not to. So, but I understand your point, that it's speculative whether or not they existed, and we don't really know, and we only have what's in the record. But let's assume for the moment there's a pretty good chance they might have existed. We still have the other issue of defense counsel and their affidavits said it was a strategic decision not to pursue them, even if they existed. Why was that? Even on that decision, it seems like there are great benefits if they did exist and they were lost, potentially. And what is the downside of, as they say, they were afraid the government would find them? What is the downside of the government finding them?
Well, Your Honor, I think first it's important to note that there's a distinction, and there should be a distinction, in pretrial strategy and sort of the lead up to trial itself and the strategy that ultimately resulted at trial. As appellant noted, there is a distinction, and that would be the trigger point of RCM 914. But to answer your question, Your Honor, the ultimate harm could have been, one, the ultimate recovery of the recordings if they did exist. And I'm assuming
and let's assume that they found them, or they found a backup, or whatever. What is the downside?
The downside to defense is that that recording would not have been beneficial to their case. It would have showed a victim in the immediate aftermath of an assault.
But what unilateral ability did the government have to introduce those tapes if the defense didn't attack her credibility?
The tapes could have unilaterally, if the defense did not attack her credibility, they probably would not have been very beneficial. However,
is there any other mechanism other than rehabilitating her testimony if after she testified that the defense attacked her credibility that they could have come in?
None that comes to mind at the current moment, Your Honor.
So isn't the defense in the driver's seat? It's up to them. They get to watch the tape. They get to see whether or not there's prior inconsistent statements or other things they can use in their defense. And if they decide, no, she said exactly the same thing when she spoke to them before, they don't raise that issue. Like, what have they lost by getting to see the tapes if they exist?
I would actually argue that it's the opposite, Your Honor, that finding the tapes would take the defense out of the driver's seat, because in the current scenario, they have free rein to impeach the victim to the extent that they are able to at trial, and there's no tapes with which the government can...
Impeach her with what?
Impeach with any inconsistencies that they're able to uncover based on the agent notes that were provided by OSI. There were some impeachments conducted during the trial that ultimately would have opened the door to these coming in as prior consistent statements. And the absence of the recording ultimately put them in the driver's seat where they could freely have full reign to cross-examine and impeach the witness without any danger that they're opening the door to prior consistent statements coming in from the recordings.
But you're pointing out that even in the agent's notes, there are inconsistencies. And going to the point that Judge Hardy is making, if they see the tape, then they know they can make that calculation in terms of, look, there are even more inconsistencies with the statement. You're only focusing on the side of the equation saying, geez, they could point out that there are consistency. Why isn't Judge Hardy correct in terms of saying throughout this process, if the defense counsel had pursued the motion, they would have remained in the driver's seat throughout. And the remedy through a 914 motion is so dramatic that they should have pursued it.
I think ultimately, Your Honor, while a reasonable attorney certainly could have thought that that strategy was worthwhile in pursuing, it's conversely, a reasonable attorney could have believed that the government not being in possession of potentially prior consistent statements that could be used to rehabilitate the victim is also a viable strategy. And ultimately, what we're assessing is whether no reasonable attorney would have made the decisions that trial defense counsel did. And given that there are two viable pathways of strategy, that it's not unreasonable for trial defense counsel to have determined that it was in their client's interest for the government to not possess or go looking for the recordings at issue.
This kind of goes full circle to the point that the IDP said they were deleted.
Again, Your Honor, agreeing that that was what was stated in the IDPs and that was what was ultimately testified to at trial, there was not sufficient evidence based on what trial defense counsel knew at the time that they made their decision, knowing, based on the disclosure from assistant trial counsel, that no one could confirm whether those recordings had ever existed in any format ever at all. That they knew that if they made that motion, that was an element that they were going to have to prove. That's something that they would have to establish in order to succeed on an RCM 914 motion. And while there may have been a prima facie case based on the testimony in the IDP that these were deleted, the standard that they would have had to have proven that they existed by at trial would have been by a preponderance of the evidence under RCM 905. And given the disclosure from assistant trial counsel, what trial defense counsel ultimately knew is that if they explored this and if they went into a 914 hearing, what likely would have come out is that no one could actually confirm whether the recordings ever existed to begin with.
Now, in terms of, though, the affidavits that were submitted by the defense counsel, they didn't say what you just said. Isn't that important? One of the defense counsel, even though that was the issue that was sent to them, one of the defense counsel didn't even address 914. And the other defense counsel said, you know what, in terms of how this played out, we were using it to attack the agent in terms of the fact that it's not here. But they still had this bazooka out there so that attacking the professionalism of the agent didn't in any way compare with their ability, if the 914 motion had been successful, to blow up the whole trial. So the argument you're making, I understand it, but that's not what defense counsel said in their affidavits.
Well, Your Honor, in their declarations, they did specifically address the primary area of concern, whether it was under 703 or whether it was under RCM 914, that both Major ultimately concluded that the issue was that they could not definitively prove that these recordings ever existed to begin with. And while they didn't, Captain O did specifically mention RCM 914 in her analysis, and that was going to be the seminal issue that they needed to prove, and that they could not do that. And while Major did not specifically address RCM 914, the fact that she identified the exact issue which would have ultimately led to the RCM 914 motion being futile means that in many ways it was considered by defense counsel their ability to prove whether these recordings existed. And it was reasonable for them under the circumstances and based on what they knew from the various disclosures to conclude that they would not have ultimately been successful in the 914 motion. And had they made the 914 motion and gone to a hearing, what ultimately would have resulted is they would have failed, and the testimony at trial that it was deleted would have been undercut, and that would have allowed the government to recall the special agent and clear it up that the recording wasn't deleted, that in fact no one can confirm it ever existed, and that would significantly weaken trial defense counsel's strategy because...
Now, would that have weakened trial defense counsel's strategy, or would it have made the investigator look inept. I just testified that they deleted. Now I'm coming in and say, oh, no, I was wrong.
A reasonable defense counsel could have believed that it was much more impactful to hear that an OSI agent had obtained evidence and then let that evidence subsequently been deleted, as opposed to, which is a violation of law, it would have been a violation of RCM 914 and the obligation that RCM 914 creates, as opposed to testimony that an OSI agent, a new and experienced agent, simply forgot to press record or there was a software glitch.
Why is that better? You say that they'd come in and they would prove that it never existed. So, again, this gets back to, like, you have to excuse our negligence because we were negligent. I don't understand how any of this really is to the benefit of the government in their case. It just seems like it undermines the creditworthiness of the entire investigation and prosecution.
Well, I think now is a good time to talk about the negligence, Your Honor. Specifically, I think the way it would have come out is it would have, in some ways, rehabilitated OSI, because we have to look at the reasons why, like how it was discovered that these recordings never existed to begin with. And it wasn't as the result of a defense counsel's request for discovery. It came out as a result of the agent taking the affirmative steps to try to go in good faith effort, to preserve the evidence as she knew she was required to do, albeit it was late. But ultimately what she went in to find just never existed. You can't preserve evidence that never existed. And that's what would have ultimately come out at trial. But it's also important to note that this was not a recording that they had any interest in losing, and there's no evidence of any malfeasance or intent, either in the non-recording of the interviews or even if they'd lost the interviews. There's no evidence that this was intentional, that would rise to the level under, SIGRA or MUWACIL. And it's very different than those cases, and I see my time's about to expire, Your Honor. May I continue?
Questions from the bench?
I mean, to that point, you know, and you're trying to argue that this isn't grossly negligent, and that's fine, but there's a lot of shades of negligence. Like, if the recordings were recorded and then they got deleted, why were they deleted?
Despite a good faith effort made by OSI to preserve the evidence, it was a failure. It would have been ultimately a failure to follow policy, assuming for argument's sake that your hypothetical is true.
Well, I mean, say they existed on their system. They were recorded. They existed in a digital format on their system or tape, whatever they record them on. How did they, if we assume the policies were just followed, the procedures were followed, how did they get deleted?
Ultimately, it would have likely been a result of a failure to follow the policy to preserve. But it's important to
Is it following the policy to delete them after a certain amount of time?
So to be clear, there was no policy in place in this case to delete them after a certain period of time, Your Honor.
Was that just a procedure?
That is the nature of the recording system itself. This is very different than SIGRA, where they specifically did have a policy where they allowed evidence to spoliate. This is not that case. There was no policy in place to not record these. In fact, there was a policy to the contrary, to preserve these when they were recorded.
To preserve them by copying them onto a more permanent format.
Correct, Your Honor.
And letting the temporary recordings be deleted.
Correct, Your Honor.
And that is the government's choice. To set up that system, that is the government's choice.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not like the building burned down or there was some other sort of failure that they couldn't foresee. The government made an active choice in how to treat these materials.
They made a choice in setting up and establishing a variety of policies specifically designed to accord with the requirements of RCM 14, that they do preserve these, that they're burned to a disk in a timely fashion, which is very, very different than what we had in SIGRA, where Army CID specifically allowed all non-subject interviews to automatically be overwritten by the recording system. And where we have policies in place that are specifically designed to protect and accord with 914, we should not look at SIGRA as a guidepost, because SIGRA, it was a prime example of exactly what 914 was designed to protect against.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Major Blythe?
To begin, this court and federal courts have not imposed a requirement to prove that a recording once existed in a functional format. That's what the government would like to be the case here, and that seems to be what trial defense counsel believed But importantly, they don't cite a case for that proposition in their declarations or say that it's grounded in this court's case law. They provide alternative justifications about what might have happened. If you're speculating about what might have happened to the video, you file a motion and you find out in a hearing. And this court has in the past relied on the regularity of practices as sufficient there. Sigra is one example of where the testimony, at least at the trial court, about what happened for the videos and the recording was merely that the agents, it's their regular practice to always press a button to start the recording. So there's kind of a presumption of regularity when courts have looked at the generation of the evidence in the first place. On the strategic decision that counsel made to file or not file, I think the declarations betray a lot of confusion between 914 and 703. And the bleed over in the analysis is problematic because those arise at different moments and those have different burdens too. And the tests are different. And so to the degree, Captain OH even acknowledges that she viewed 914 through the lens of her experience with RCM 703. And that's deeply problematic that instead of saying I've read these court cases and I still made this decision, instead it was I had experience with a separate rule and that influenced my decision on RCM 914.
Counsel, can I ask you to respond to one thing that government counsel said? The government counsel said that, in fact, in cross-examining the witness, her questions were asked that impeached her testimony and that would have allowed prior consistent statements to be admitted. Is that your understanding?
Your Honor, on a limited basis, that could have been. I mean, the defense counsel's strategy that they explained in their declarations was not a slap.
I'm just talking about the actual record that happened. Did they cross-examine her such that prior consistent statements could have been admitted?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that some limited would. But to the point that was made on the bench, that it's not necessarily meaning the video comes in. They may have been able to bring out that there were prior consistent statements, but that doesn't wholesale mean the video comes in, which generated some of the would generate some of the concerns that trial defense counsel talked about her being disheveled, this happening right after the allegation, and some of the other concerns. So it's not this court's precedent that wholesale the video would come in. And to address one of your questions, Judge Maggs, from earlier, if this court finds that the record is insufficient, it's still capable of ordering a Dubé to probe these, to see if there's enough evidence for an ineffective assistance of counsel claims. I see my time has expired.
I just have one question. They didn't mention it, but in their briefs they mentioned this issue of the appearance of the victim on the video. It could have been detrimental to the defense strategy. Am I right that there are also high-resolution photographs in the record of the injury sustained by the victim?
Yes, Your Honor. We put 20 of those in the joint appendix, and those are presented to the members. And, in fact, those even used an artificial light technology that made them appear even more impactful, I think, than what the plain eye would otherwise see.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Blythe.
Thank you, Your
Honor. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.